I'm Catherine Newman, Amherst class of 1990, and also the academic department coordinator here in creative writing. And I'm here today with Richard Todd, Amherst class of 1962, who's also been a friend of mine for 22 years now. For only half of those did I call him Mr. Todd. Dick has worked for a long time as an editor and writer. He was executive editor at the Atlantic Monthly, an editor at New England Monthly. He published books under his own imprint at Houghton Mifflin, where his authors included Tracy Kidder and Ann Patchett. His own work has appeared in The Atlantic, Harper's, The New York Times, and other magazines on topics as diverse as Disney World, politics, and wealth. He's taught literature and writing at Amherst and Smith Colleges, at the University of Massachusetts, and at Goucher College, where he's a current faculty member. And I'm here to talk to him about his new book, The Thing Itself, which is a meditation on the very slippery problem of authenticity through such diverse phenomena as rural landscape, famous people, public weeping, art, and sex. Dick, last week at your reading in Northampton, you talked about your shifting sense of being real and unreal in the world and of the world itself seeming more or less real or false. And I guess I wanted to ask you whether you knew all along that authenticity was what you were writing about, or whether it was more like a basket that you gathered your ideas into, or more like you connected dots and it turned out you'd created a picture of authenticity.
It happened in a couple of ways. I looked back on things I'd written, magazine pieces, and I saw that there was an idea sort of trying to find its way out, and that it was called, or could be called, authenticity. And then I got involved in that old house that you know, and I was restoring it, quote. And I got kind of unhealthily interested in getting it right, I think. And so I asked myself, why is this? What's really going on here? And that, as much as anything, sort of crystallized it. The book turns out to have nothing to do with, or very little to do with, old houses, but and there are only a couple of pages on it. But when I realized how much I cared about it, I thought there must be something else going on here in my mind.
And then did that produce this kind of panoply of subjects that you turned that to as a lens, or were those already all the things you had been interested in sort of without necessarily recognizing the authenticity theme of them?
Well, I just looked around and I saw that there were things that did connect, things to start with. I mean, the first part of the book, as you know, is about things and the place the material world plays in our lives. And I got very interested in ideas about materialism and people's, what came to seem to me, a sort of reflexive criticism of us as a materialistic society. And that always seemed to me a sort of, or came to seem to me anyway, a sort of dead end. And so that seemed to lead to places. I was doing a lot of travel writing at the time. And travel writing is such a funny paradox in that you're always going out and looking for the real place, which you are then trying to promote to people who want the real place too, although they don't want to see anyone else there who is looking for the same thing you are. So that struck me as amusing and kind of paradoxical. And also I realized how much I had invested in being in the country, living in the country, and that I was drawing from that something that I thought of as authenticity. And so on we went.
The issue of the country, I was thinking about that. It is one of the opening sections of the book, and I was thinking about how you describe the paradox of the way you, on the one hand, yearn for this kind of simple life that seems like it would be the most authentic kind of life, like the farmers you see around you, where it's you and the land and the sheep and, you know, the farm-to-table meals. And then on the other hand, you rue the way that the very kind of striving after that authentic life is itself a kind of pretense. You know, you talk about the looking at your barn, which you describe as a museum of false enthusiasms, which is really a great line. And I guess I wondered if that, in a way, was a not a metaphor, but in a way, if that describes the project of going after authenticity, whether it's always that paradox of, you know, kind of like how you can't be enlightened in Buddhism if you want to be enlightened. You know, you can only be sort of authentic if you're not going after it. I was just wondering if that seemed to resonate for you.
Toward the end of this book, I said to myself, oh my God, Buddhism. I don't know anything about Buddhism. Really, and obviously Buddhism is the answer here, isn't it? It was too tragically too late. So at least I avoided that self-conscious search for enlightenment.
That's good.
But you're right. I mean, I think this is a very elusive subject. You sort of have to sneak up on it, catch it from the side, and really, authenticity names a desire or a longing rather than a condition, at least if you're talking about yourself.
It makes me think of the place in the book where you describe, you know, the authentic self, not as kind of something in a glass box as much as a block of wood that's the same through and through, or an onion that's many layers, all of them onion.
I guess the subject was openness, and I was writing about how openness at a certain point became a virtue, a social virtue. We wanted to praise someone who said they're very honest, very open, and I started thinking about what openness meant, and I realized that I really, to the extent that it was utter transparency, like a glass box, I didn't want to be open, and I didn't really want anyone else to be terrifically open in that way. You did sort of hope for yourself that there was this kind of consistency of being. I guess it's meaning one of authenticity. There's the idea that there is some sort of whole self there, that even if it has its privacies, as we hope it does, that its privacies are not utterly at war with the surface, you know, that somehow you are not, even though you may not share your innermost self, whatever that is, you're not at war with it. You're not betraying it in your ordinary daily life.
When you write about the kind of proliferation of junk and disposable stuff and conspicuous consumption, and you're self-consciously not just, you know, kind of lamenting it in the usual way, you're really trying to look at it. And there are two lines I wanted to ask you about. I bet you know what they're going to be. One line is, I sometimes wish we were more materialistic, not less. And the other line is, we need to be better materialists. And I just, especially for people who haven't read the book, I was wondering if you might just say a little bit about what that means.
We get a bad rap. We give ourselves a bad rap as a culture, as people who are obsessed with material things. And it's just a kind of ancient, reflexive cultural criticism, and I just started turning this idea over in my head. And one thing that occurred to me is that some of this stuff we actually don't like very much, and what we like is buying it more than having, and And I also started thinking about how people who live a very deliberate, self-aware life of material deprivation become rather obsessed with things.
Conspicuous parsimony.
Yes, right, exactly, yeah. And I remember during hippie days, I had a friend who was traveling around in a kind of in a van, and his whole life was there. And he was, I've never known a person who was more involved with his things, his axe, you know, and his bow saw and his camp stove. And I realized there is no escape from this. Who are people? What is the species? It thinks and talks, and then it wears clothes, you know, and not necessarily in that order. And it makes tools, and we just have stuff. So, and it occurred to me that really what you want to do is take it seriously and put it in its place, but take it seriously, not hate it. And there's no real sort of responsibility to the planet message in this book, although it does occur to me that if we were better materialists, the planet might be better off too.
And you say at some point that, I think in the preface, you say that the book's not going to be an inventory of the unreal, but I did watch at the reading somebody, what people want to do is trot stuff past you to get your take on it. And I'm just wondering if that is happening to you all over the place. Because the whole time I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, I got to ask Dick about that margarine called I Can't Believe It's Not Butter. And I got to ask Dick about, you know, communion wafers and, you know, like talk about the thing itself, right? I mean, every single thing I was reading, I thought, oh, yeah, I want to hear his take on that. And I was just wondering if people are just constantly running stuff by you, and as you were writing, if people kept saying, "Hey, did you watch the movie The Truman Show?" And
no one has tried to pin me down on transubstantiation, yeah. Catherine. Not until now, anyway. And I think I'll pass on that one. Right? A lot of thought has been given in, yeah, to that question, but yes, people, and it is. Let's face it; it's fun to talk about it, and I fall into to it myself. I mean, I write about the most obviously, one of the most obviously faux things in our culture, Disney World, after all. I couldn't resist. And so, yeah, it is fun. But I didn't want to just sort of, I try not to make this a finger-wagging book. You know, I'm trying not to indict anybody. I'm right in the middle of the problem here.
Oh, certainly. Oh, as you really never seem to forget. I was thinking actually about you too when I was at my dentist reading People magazine, you know, the guilty pleasure of reading People magazine. It's at the dentist. I didn't buy it, you know.
Right, and you're about to experience pain and suffering. Why do you need this?
I need People magazine, but there was, I thought of you because you write about celebrity this way, this paradox where on the one hand, they're completely unreal, and that's the strange appeal of them. And on the other hand, we're constantly kind of projecting onto them our own sort of normalness. And there was a section in this People magazine called They're Just Like Us. Have you ever seen this?
No, but...
And it's, you know, it's Britney Spears buying Tampax, and it's... You know, it's Al Pacino yelling at his kid in a parking lot. It's like every kind of debased moment of human life. Yeah. And I thought, I don't actually really want them to be just like us. And I was thinking about you and politics and the way you make a similar point about politicians, that on the one hand, we're asking somebody to run the country, and on the other hand, we seem to want them to be just like the most kind of debased versions of ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, we think about it right now in this season where here we are again. And you think about these people who, out of something, out of ruthlessness or or sheer lustful ambition or narcissism or, you know, conceivably out of a great nobility of purpose. The entire force of their life has been directed upward. They are striving for distinction. And then we, as a culture, turn around and accuse them of elitism, or we want mm-hmm. them to demonstrate their ordinariness, which is one thing we mean by their, quote, authenticity. And it's loopy. I mean, the job is impossible. We don't want an ordinary person to do it. And yet, it's understandable, too, because we were groping for some, you know, we know the world is full of surprises. We're looking for character that we can connect with. Still, it is a very strange paradox that we want these people to be, quote, just like us.
I suppose I had a follow-up to a question about politics, which is, it's a two-part question about postmodernism, which you take some issue with in the book, despite what I take to be your sort of sympathy with the idea of life being to some extent the stories we tell about it. And I was wondering if there's like a backstory to that, if there's someone you're taking issue with in particular, or something apolitical that's rubbing you the wrong way about it. The question keeps emerging in my mind is, what's your beef with postmodernism? But I guess I was just curious about it. It seems to kind of come up with some force of something behind it.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what that something is.
I guess I have felt that there was an easiness about a lot of it. Easy in the sense that one could select what one wanted to find provisional or insubstantial or a construct. But it's a rare postmodernist who truly applies that doctrine to life, you know, especially when things really get serious. It seemed to me to be often a kind of entertainment and also a way to sort of slip out of the responsibility of saying something serious. It's interesting to think of this in the history of this college, actually.
Yes, I was going to ask you that.
Because for those of us who are here, and I'm could lapse into nostalgic old boyhood here, but those of us who were here pre-postmodern for English 1-2, the famous course, felt that we had heard all this in its purest form. That is, that course, and that there was a certain sort of sensibility here in the 60s and 70s that made you very skeptical of language, very aware of the paradox that language was the only tool you had, but that it had its very severe limits, and that your task was to try to work around those limits through invention. And for this then to have been codified as a kind of fashion, I think maybe that's my grudge.
Uh-huh.
With it. I said, I think when all of this was presented to us as revelation, I thought, well, I know this, but that's just life. And then you move on from that. You don't make it into a religion.
Now that you have talked about the college, I was wondering if there are moments that really stand out for you that you feel like sort of would affect all your subsequent thinking and writing. not necessarily moments, but courses or professors or ideas that just really changed the course of your personhood?
Well, I think English, English 1, English 21, the whole English department as it then was affected me. I can't, it's very hard to remember moments, and the moments you remember are not always the most significant. I remember Ben DeMott doing a real number on someone who these were more formal days. Someone brought a sandwich or something to class, and this was not done. You didn't eat.
Yeah, you smoked.
All right, you could smoke.
But you didn't eat. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you didn't have water either. So I remember that little scene, and I remember Ted Baird telling people to for God's sakes, get up and wash their faces in the morning before they came to class. So these are not lessons really to live by somehow. I mean, but I do remember personalities and sensibility in a sort of pervasive way of looking at the world. And that was, for me, that was particularly embodied in Ben DeMott, who became a lifelong friend of mine.
There's this moment you talk about, which I really love. You're writing about Las Vegas, and you talk about, on the one hand, the tremendous relief, and I know exactly this feeling because I have this feeling too, in Las Vegas in particular, but also in a way in anywhere that's so enormously fake that you feel completely freed from the burden of searching out authenticity. There it is. That's what it is. It's authentically fake. You know, what a tremendous relief. Yep. And somebody asks you about it when you get back, and you say, it just seems like, you know, you have a great time there. You're so kind of relieved to be in this just enormously fake place. And, but looking forward to being home, and somebody asks you about it, and you say, well, it was a lot of fun, but I think it would have been less fun if I hadn't been writing about it. Which you then go on to make a point about Vegas being a place that everyone's there to write about. But I was thinking about that being almost a metaphor for my entire life. It was a lot of fun, and it would have been a lot less fun if I hadn't been writing about it. And I have just been struggling with whether the fact that I live, as you describe, to some extent in the future perfect, this, I later will be at dinner telling the story of how I interviewed Dick Todd. You know, to some extent, these things become stories as I live them. And there's so much pleasure in that for me. I mean, I enjoy living like that, but I was trying to think about whether that is a solution for me to the problem of authenticity, or whether it's the problem itself. And I don't know if that's become a question yet for you, but do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. On the one hand, this sense of yourself as an observer of your own life it keeps experience at bay, or at least it puts up a little shield between you and the direct and direct experience. On the other hand, I mean, the upside of that is that you learn things as you write, you know, that you didn't know quite while you were living them. I mean, people always tell people to write about what they know, and I sometimes tell students, no, that isn't quite it. I mean, that's a little bit of a lie or a distortion. If you just write about what you know, it's like self-stenography, you know? I mean, if you write about what you figure out as you write, right? And so in that sense, a life of observation, I think, is not a bad thing.
Let's end there. Dick, thank you.
Thank you.